No, it's not Saturday Afternoon in the 70s. That was the longest theme song we've done yet.
We had a slight technical issue right there, didn't we?
There's been a few technical issues today.
Oh, no kidding. Man, I'm just lucky I got here. So are everybody in the studio.
Well, to everyone who's enjoying Saturday afternoon in the comforts of home, here in suburban Stillwater, we had a little challenge today. This is Flashback Twin Cities. Tom Osmond joining with Tom Hsu, and we got a great show today. But we have to just mention that came into the station today, and I thought that a parade was going on today. How fun. Not fun for me because I had to park a mile away. But they had the police cars barricading the roads, and I thought, well, of course, the paraders, the floats need to come down, and people were camped out watching it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I didn't get the tweet that there was a suspected bomb placed in a Stillwater bank after a man robbed it appears to be fake inactive device, according to the Star Tribune. The FBI, Stillwater Police, and Washington County Sheriff's Office have been investigating the bomb threat since about 9:30 Saturday, shutting down much of downtown Stillwater within a two-block radius of U.S. Bank, which includes 104 North Main Street, the studios of KLBB Radio, where music and memories live.
Fortunately, you're not bitter at all. I heard it as I was driving down and heard Stan Turner, the very start of his show, and he mentioned it, and I went past the wrong exit, and I got stuck in the giant traffic jam going down into downtown Stillwater. Like, just missed it.
You know, thankfully for the great police force of
Indeed.
Stillwater and Oak Park Heights and the State Patrol, I utmost respect. I apologize for my somewhat ignorance of the situation as I decided to just go to the station here and had to explain why I was about ready to break some laws. And
now what did you do? Did you just not even ask and just go under the tape?
I thought that if I made it under the tape that the parade would have just went around me. I didn't realize until I was briefed on the situation.
Briefed very kindly, I'm sure.
But it was great that we were able to get not only Jason Davis in the studio safely and his three grandchildren who are also in the studio audience today, but also Stan Turner's guests. And we're all here, and it's a nice sunny day, and let's just be happy.
I am.
Great. Was sad last Saturday, though, after the show. Did you hear with the news?
No. What happened?
You're a younger guy. Do you recall the show All in the Family?
I do.
Well, actress Jean Stapleton, known as Edith Bunker on All in the Family, died at age 90. Actress Jean Stapleton, best known for her role as Archie Bunker's wife in the groundbreaking 1970 sitcom All in the Family, has died, her son said Saturday. She was 90 years old. The daughter of an opera singer and businessman, Stapleton grew up on Long Island and in New York City. It was there during the early 1940s, while working as a typist for the British War Ministry Office, that she began her career in theater. All in the Family was on for about 11 years in two different incarnations.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of clips, but I want to play one audio clip. This is Archie and Edith Bunker shopping at a supermarket. When Archie was unemployed, this is the 70s, height of inflation, height of a lot of challenges in this country, and this is a typical All in the Family episode.
Gotta be glad I went shopping with you, Edith, when you see how much money I keep getting spent.
Oh, you just wait and see.
Look at the height of the prices on them shelves. The whole world's going to hell in the shopping baskets.
Archie, I told you so.
Just remember, I'm unemployed, Edith. Oh, geez, don't be grabbing with both hands. Spending my money faster than I ain't earning it. Why are we shopping in Ferguson's anyway?
Ferguson's is crooks.
Oh, gee, it's a nice place, and it's in the neighborhood.
Yeah, there better be a poorhouse in the neighborhood. But what is this? Wait a minute, why is beans 49 cents a can?
Because it's on sale. The regular price is 53 cents. Unless you find a dented can, then it's 2 cents cheaper.
Archie proceeds to dent the cans to get 2 cents off his can of beans.
I don't think I could ever listen to her talk normally. I would be floored if she said anything other than, you know, Archie.
No, it is weird. You see her on interviews, especially now with all the retrospectives going on, and it's you just want her to say, do the Edith voice.
Just do it.
Just do it. And she wouldn't do it to her credit, to us. Untamed rubes and the masses wanting her to just do the voice. She wouldn't do it.
What else has she done, by the way?
Well, according to the report here from CNN, she continued to work in theater, including a nationwide tour as Roosevelt in her one-woman show, Eleanor, Her Secret Journey.
Hmm.
The Broadway revival of Arsenic and Old Lace, and Olby Award performances, and Harold Printer's Mountain Language and the Birthday Party. Her final stage appearance was in The Carpetbagger's Children, a few blocks from her home in New York, to which she returned prematurely in 2002.
Well,
here's some trivia for you, and yeah. Then I will end the really outdated sitcom and TV trivia. She was the original choice for Murder, She Wrote, one of your favorite shows.
Really?
Really. She was that was who Murder, She Wrote was supposed to be.
For
Jean
her?
Stapleton.
It was written for
that
her.
That's correct.
Why did she turn that down?
Apparently she, that just wasn't her project.
Was it maybe too violent?
I think it was a little too violent for Jean Stapleton. Maybe a little bit too predictable. We come back. We have Jason Davis, who is not predictable. He is he's jet-setting across the world and all around Minnesota. And he will be back after this break to talk about his days at KSDP and whatever else we can talk about on Flashback Twin Cities on KLBB. Flashback Twin Cities, Tom Osmond with my special guest, Jason Davis of KSDP TV Channel 5. Welcome to Flashback Twin
Cities.
Good
afternoon to you.
Jason and I were just talking about British comedy and how all these American shows that probably most people in America probably think that we invented them, but they all were basically copied from the British, especially All in the Family. And at you were mentioning, what year did you come to America?
1975.
So you came right at the height of all these British comms coming to America.
I was familiar with all the British comedy shows, and then I came here, and all of a sudden they started bobbing up here in the American version.
The American watered-down version. what was the name of the Archie Bunker equivalent in UK?
I don't remember.
Was it like Alfred something? I knew this one.
Faulty Towers?
No. Well, there's that
You're
one.
You're going back too many.
That's what we do here. 1975, you came to go work where when you came here?
Well, I arrived in New York looking at, with a tape. I'd already worked in television for 7 years in Australia. So I thought I was a pretty experienced reporter. And I couldn't get a job. Nobody would even give me a chance. And the guy at NBC said, your accent is just totally unacceptable on
really?
American television. And then it's a long story, but to make a long story short, I did get a job at in Phoenix, Arizona, at Cool TV,
K-O-O-L,
long gone, but what a wonderful name for a television station in Arizona. And they gave me a shot, and I did quite well there. I was there for 6 months, and then somebody you know and I know very well,
that's right,
Stan Turner, went down to Arizona to Sun City. I think it was Sun City to visit his mother.
His mother who was
living there. And he saw me on the air and he called me and said, would you like to come and talk to us about working in Minneapolis? I didn't know where Minneapolis was. And I said, sure. I mean, they sent me an airplane ticket and I flew up and I met Stan Hubbard and Stan Turner. And they pitched me a proposal, which was too good to resist. I went back to my wife. I said, this is our big chance. And we came here and started work at KSDP.
What month did you come to Channel 5?
October 1976.
So they didn't interview you in winter. You didn't come up during a blizzard.
No, I came up. I remember flying over Minneapolis coming from Arizona and thinking how green it was. Remember, I had lived in Australia too, which is not a green country particularly.
Right.
And I was just struck by how green and lush it was.
There's so many people that I've interviewed here that tell us the day I came to Channel 5 to interview, it was the worst blizzard of the last 5 years, and they see the power lines down, they see cars in the ditches.
Didn't happen to me.
What am I getting into?
No, I was very happy about the weather here.
Jason Davis, our guest today. So let's talk about those early years a little bit, and then I want to talk about on the road. You were born in England.
Yes.
But you were raised in Australia, or you grew up in Australia.
No. Yes and no. I was born in England in 1939, 2 months before the war broke out, raised during the war and evacuated twice out of London. And then when I went to school and grew up, and when I was 15 years old, for reasons that are pretty blurry now, but I left school at 15 and went to sea as a merchant seaman, which is a merchant marine, I think you call them in the United States, people that man the ships that carry the cargoes. And in the 50s, when I did it, it was that's how stuff moved around the world by ship. Not so much anymore, but it was then, and it was cargo, not big boxes full of cargo. So it took forever to do this. I loved it. I did it for 9 years. And then I actually jumped ship in Australia in 1964. And I worked there on and off doing different jobs for 4 years. And then got the bug to work in radio or television. And again, to cut a long story short, went into a little tiny TV station, 1968, in Australia, in a country town, and asked for a job. And they gave it to me, which $65 a week, I was thrilled to bits.
And where did you get this bug to be on TV radio? What inspired you? Okay.
I don't know. Okay. I can't answer that. I have an anecdote about being with another kid who, when we were on the ships. We were in a cafe in Melbourne, Australia, one Saturday afternoon because the pubs were closed in those days at the weekends. And we would sit in a coffee bar or a cafe, and the Greek owner came over and talked to us. And he said, well, where are you kids from? And we said, well, we're off the ship down here in Port Melbourne. And he looked at me and he said, you know, you look like you should be on television. And it stuck in my head.
And you
for
said,
years.
You said,
afterwards.
Obviously I should.
Well, I didn't even take him seriously, but I never forget him saying it. And maybe that was the seed. I don't know. But I finally decided that's what I wanted to try and do. And I took some voice production lessons, very primitive, and asked for, and went to this TV station, asked for a job, and they gave me a job as an announcer. And I swept the studio. I worked in the control room. I helped with sales. You do everything.
It sounds like what the way the broadcast model is turning into today, when we'll be doing, well, anchoring the news and then sweeping the floor.
Yeah,
after
you're going back here.
So you didn't finish formal schooling then. So you went right to radio, TV, and you didn't get a degree in journalism. Or...
I didn't. I left school when I was 15.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And somehow it's worked out for you.
It has worked out for me. I think famously I've got a wonderful family and three of them here. And I'm close to retirement now.
And you have your security detail with you today. I have to just want to point out to you that Jason came in today with three large men, and I thought, well, this must be a security detail. It's actually your grandchildren came today. And
they're called the Brute Squad.
Just trying to...
Triplets. Yeah. Triplet boys, and they're 13 in August.
Well, so in 2 years, don't go to the Merchant Marines, right?
No, I don't think so.
All right. So you made it. So you made the jump from Australia then to New York? Is that
I met my wife at the TV station in Australia, the first one I worked at, which was the small one. And she was there visiting her family. Her mother is Australian. And she was visiting her grandmother and uncles and aunts and cousins, and got a job at the TV station to earn her fare back to the U.S. She was 21 years old. I was 31. And we met, and we're still together 47 years later.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Again, these stories in broadcasting, sometimes a lot of these, there's the first wife, the second wife, the first marriage. That's fantastic.
Yep.
And you brought her to America. And then just to go back, we went back in Arizona at KOL-TV. And were you doing general assignment reporting in KOL?
Yeah, I was doing – and as indeed, I came to KSTP as a general assignment reporter, and that's what I did. Stan Turner was my boss. He was the news director at the time and the main anchor.
Right.
But I gravitated towards feature work. I always wanted to do feature work. I did some feature work in Australia because I was in television there for 7 years and evolved my craft and developed my craft there. But I always felt attracted to feature work. So as I would do a news story, I would make it into a feature. If it was at all soft, I would develop it as a story. And Stan came to me one day, and I'll never forget this, and he said, Jason, he said, why don't you do just feature stories? Don't do any more news, just feature stories.
And On the Road Again was born.
We called it By the Way for a little while.
Till Willie Nelson's song kind of became popular.
And then another news director came in, and as news directors will, they try to make it in their own image. So they change it. Everyone has changed it.
Would that be Bob Jordan?
It was Bob Jordan.
There you go. We have a little let's listen to this spot here. This is from 1984.
I witness you. Eyewitness News reporter Jason Davis.
Hey, they say the English are eccentric. Well, you have more eccentric per thousand than I think any other country in the world, and we love them all.
On the road again in Minnesota.
We've been in Beirut, Lebanon with Minnesotans. Wherever Minnesotans do something important, we're going to be there.
Jason Davis.
The eccentrics of Minnesota.
Well, you know, what's ironic is I think that was the last time that KSTP ever promoted me. We don't get any promotion.
Well, you know, it is a remarkable not only to be in TV for as many years as you have, the same station as many years as you have.
37 years at KSTP.
And yeah. To some people, they may say to be at KSTP for 37 years is remarkable. And it's Stanley.
They've
right
always
there.
Been very good to me. Very good to me and given me wonderful opportunities, so I have no regrets about working for Stan Hubbard.
Do you remember your first on-the-road segment where you actually not left outside of Minnesota and you went
maybe. Oh, you mean out of the country?
Correct.
The first major one was Jerry Spies, 1979. The way this evolved was I was reading the paper one morning at work, as we have to do, because that's mm-hmm. where we get a lot of our information. And there was a tiny little item in the Pioneer Press that said that Jerry Spies from White Bear Lake was about to arrive in Falmouth, England, and his wife Sally was going to leave White Bear Lake to go meet him. He was sailing across the Atlantic in a 10-foot boat. And that caught my eye, and I thought, I just wonder if we could do this. Mm-hmm. And I went to Stan Turner and suggested that we do it, and he said, oh, I don't know, you have to talk to Mr. Hubbard. You know, in those days, Stan Hubbard really ran things.
Which we were talking to Stanley E or Stanley S?
Stanley SS. Sure. SS. Yes. And we were in the cafeteria. And I said to him, there was the opportunity to talk to him. And I said, what about this? And Stan Hubbard is an Anglophile for one thing, and another, he's a sailing enthusiast mm-hmm. and loves marine stories. Mm-hmm. And he knew about it, and I said, what about us going over and meeting him when he arrives? And he said, call Northwest and see if they'll give you a free ride first. And they'd said no. So I went over to him, and I said, well, Northwest turned us down. He said, well, let's go anyway. So that was a huge thrill because we had to leave and go to England. It was my birthday around by July 1979. And Bill Junton and I, the photographer I was working with, had to fly to London. Mm-hmm. And then they got us a flight plane to fly down to Falmouth. And it was a tremendous success. We were on the boat with Sally Spies when she first saw Jerry. We had it exclusively internationally. It was an international story. There was a lot of media, but no television, only us.
And his boat's name was?
Yankee Girl.
Exactly, that's right. And I describe the boat for me. I've tried to find the tape to put on the website to add context, but that tape is still to be found yet. But the boat was a small boat.
Jerry said he laid on his garage floor and got a piece of chalk and drew a line around his body and built the boat to fit it in. So it was 10 feet long. It's the size of a small dinghy that you would row out to your big boat.
How was he when you met him? Was he ready to be on land when you met him?
Yeah, he was fine. He was just fine. He's a very, very clever man and thought this through. Former teacher, mm-hmm. And he's still alive. I talked to him. I know I didn't talk to him, but I did call him, left a message. He's still, but I know he's still around. His voice was on the voicemail, so I hope he calls me back.
It'd be great to have on the show sometime. Jason Davis, my guest from KSTP, talking about the Jerry Spies story, which was international news, and KSTP was the only crew to be there meeting him in Thelma. And again, that's a great story because I always thought that he would have been sickly and ready to like be drugged back to shore and eat a burger.
Yeah,
after
he looked
after
great.
That.
He was in very good. He, as I said, he was a very careful man that thought things through and took care of himself. And he was in very good physical condition. 2 years later, we went around the world with him from California to Australia. He sailed the same boat, mm-hmm. Yankee Girl, and we did a documentary about that too.
Yeah, how do you top that? Once you went to sail the Atlantic, then you have to continue to keep topping yourself.
Well, we've kind of run out of that kind of adventure now.
What in the last few years, you've been doing a show called On the Road. So you actually have a half-hour show. Were you able to do your...
We did have a half-hour show. about 10 years ago, 9 years ago, they asked me to produce a half-hour program, and they gave me a staff. Mm-hmm. And it was we did very well. We produced a lot of half-hour programs. It ran weekly, mm-hmm. and it was called On the Road. And then came 2008, and the economy took such a hit, mm-hmm. and everybody got hurt. And, you know, KSTP wasn't immune, and they had a cutback in a lot of areas. And this is one of the areas where they cut back.
Right.
So it was decided that we would put the shows on still, but repeat the inventory of 130 programs that we had already, mm-hmm. run them again, mm-hmm. for a year. That was 5 years ago. We're still running them because they still rate very, very highly.
Right, right.
We do a new program when we can. Well, two of us now working on the program. But my main task is to produce a high-level feature, high-quality feature for Sunday night's news at 10:30. That's a fixture. Mm-hmm. But at 11 on a Sunday night, we have the half-hour program, many of which are repeats. Mm-hmm. And people do get a bit upset. They call me or email me and say, when are you going to do a new show? But we don't have the wherewithal to make new programs.
Right.
But we are doing as many as we can. We do make compilation programs. We gather the stories that we've been shooting for the news and put them under an umbrella. And I'm working on a couple of those now. We travel internationally two or three times a year, maybe more, on stories that are worth a half-hour program. And we're developing those. We're working on. We just came back from China. We recently came back from St. Lucia in the West Indies. We have a program scheduled for in November. July. July 16th, I think it is, about a Minnesota group who are in St. Lucia, and they're determined to raise the IQ of the entire nation by 20%. It's called Global Volunteers. You might have heard of them. And we spent a week in St. Lucia watching them do that.
It's amazing.
It's an amazing story, and that will be on July 16th.
July 16th on KSTP Channel 5.
I think it's 16th. Maybe it's the 14th.
We'll verify that.
It's a Sunday. It's a Sunday, obviously. Right. So I don't know.
What, and you've been to Lebanon, you've been to Beirut. Do you remember a time where you had an assignment and you thought, do I really want to go there? And then you had the ticket in hand and a little bit of cold feet as you're going into that jet?
Well, yes. Always when you're going to a third world country, you have not cold feet but some trepidation because with a big camera and a tripod and a crew, mm-hmm. you tend to stand out and people are very suspicious. Mm-hmm. So there's always a problem or at least the fear of a problem with customs and immigration. And we often run into problems like that. Mm-hmm. In Mexico once, they confiscated all of our equipment for 4 days in Guadalajara because we didn't – who knows why?
Didn't fill the right paperwork, didn't have the right permit.
Who really knows why? Right. And the only man that could release our equipment was never there.
Right.
So it took us 4 days of real intense work to get our equipment back. That's not – atypical. We sometimes that happens, and there's always the fear of it happening. So that's, but for physical fear, I've been nervous, but in Beirut particularly, we were there just a few days after the bombing of the barracks, mm-hmm. Where 300 and something GIs were killed, and they were very, very sensitive there, and there were a lot of roadblocks that you didn't know who they were. And they would stop you. An ABC reporter was shot dead at a roadblock in South America at that time. It was always, life is cheap in mm-hmm. those countries. Mm-hmm. It's not like here. You know, right. If you offend them in some way, could shoot you, and they will get away with it.
And there's no conscience.
There's no justice. Mm-hmm. You know, they just disappear into the woodwork, and you're dead. And there's no protection. So
you were
Not everywhere, but some places.
You traveled during the first Gulf War in 1991. Yes. I remember there's a picture of seeing you. You're doing a stand-up, and I think there's an explosion behind you.
That wasn't an explosion. That was the burning oil wells. The Iraqis set all the oil wells on fire in Kuwait and in southern Iraq. as just a malicious damage. And we were quite struck by that because we were in a Kuwait city shortly after the Iraqis left, and they had completely trashed the entire city.
Most it's amazing video. Amazing video when you see Kuwait after the Iraqis left. Just it looks like a
wasteland.
Exactly.
Yeah, they were so malicious. They went to the university with dump trucks, big trucks. They backed the trucks up to the first floor, and they went on the second and third floor and threw the computers out of the window into the truck and hauled them away. What use they were after that, I can't imagine. Most, if not all, of the cars in Kuwait
were burned.
Well, were burned, or they was up on blocks and every wheel was gone. All the wheels were gone. But the most striking thing, and we did a story about this in Kuwait City, was that there was a children's playground on the esplanade on the ocean. Mm-hmm. And in their as they left, they drove a tank right through the playground and just trashed it. The hotel we stayed at was the Holiday Inn Crown Plaza. Now, you know, that sounds pretty nice, doesn't it? Crown Plaza Hotel.
Well, until you see the city state and zip code, I guess.
And it was a beautiful building, but the Iraqis had just left, and as a parting shot, they had poured gasoline all over the lobby, all over the marble steps, and lit it, which filled the whole hotel with thick black smoke, and every window was just blackened, and then they'd fired a couple of rounds out of at the windows as they went down the road. So they had just maliciously damaged the hotel, and we checked in, and they gave us candles to take to our rooms. There was no water and no electricity, and every room, it smelled as like a fire had been on, been burning there, which it had, and it was just filthy. And the funny part of that is when I came back and I asked for my Priority Club points, because they only gave me a written, handwritten, because there were no computers,
right.
A handwritten receipt. I turned it into the Holiday Inn people, and somebody must have taken pity on me, because it was $1,500 at that time for the 8 or 9 days we stayed there. And they sent me enough points to get a color television. They sent me 50,000 points. Somebody must have said, this guy is prepared to stay at the Crown Plaza in Kuwait. He deserves a few more points.
He's a tough guy. I thought you were going to say, those points aren't valid. They're on a handwritten piece of paper. Sorry. keep saving. That's a great story.
Yeah. You got me really curious, though. I mean, when you are prepping to go to these kind of locations, do you attempt to blend in, or you just have so much equipment you can't even
Blend in? You stand out because you've got a big camera and a tripod, and the guy I work with, 6'3", which is a little taller than me. And people respond to cameras. They're sensitive about them. They either want to be involved or they don't want to be involved. So a big TV camera is a bit of a red flag.
So there's no way you can hide yourself at all.
And if you try that, you're going to get into trouble.
Does that give you any kind of protection, though? Because you're the guy with the camera. Everyone knows
I'm not the guy with the camera. The cameraman is the guy with the camera. I'm standing right beside him.
Jason's running. He has nothing in his hand. He can run fast.
The networks, when they're in very dangerous places, and quite rightly hire security people, but we've never felt the need.
Have you ever had your footage confiscated? Ever have your tapes or your film taken?
No.
That's great.
It's happened. Not to me, but it's happened to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. When that happens, does it just waste like 3 weeks worth of
time?
Well,
yeah. Reporters and producers got smart, and they would ask in the old days for their cans of film, they would give them cans of unexposed film, and then when they asked for videotapes, we'd give them the videotapes that didn't have images on. But you know what? That's risky too.
Yeah, they see you're trying to play a game with them.
Yeah, you know, they can hold you up. You only have to be held up at customs and you miss your flight. And then what? I mean, it's really, really, really difficult to get out of these countries if you don't make that flight out that you're scheduled out on.
The next one might not come for a week.
And then you've got the penalties to pay, and maybe the flight is full. Mm-hmm. I mean, getting to the airport and getting through customs and immigration is the biggest hurdle we have. And once we're through there, And we can only then can we relax.
And did it get worse after 9/11? Was it just did it?
Much worse. Yeah, I mean, there were days when I remember being in Hawaii, and I had a story recorded for a television station in Australia that asked me, the station I used to work for, had asked me to do a report on Jerry Spies, and I did it for them. And we went to the airport, and there were people standing in line to get on the flight to Australia. And I said to some guy, "Would you mind taking this box and taking it to Melbourne? And there'll be somebody at the airport to meet." He says, "No problem." Now, can you imagine that happening today?
today, the police barricade outside would be small compared to what Jason would have had at the airport if he would have given a box away.
There's no way. But that was how casual things were. We used to take videotapes to the airport here and just hand them to the desk. And that's how we shipped stories. And they would just give it to the pilot.
Well, now they leak it on the internet before they would hand it off.
Yeah.
Let's take a break, and when we come back, I want to talk about one of my favorite, actually probably my favorite all-time story that you did involving a place called the North Pole.
Yeah.
So let's take a break on Flashback Twin Cities on KLBB. Flashback Twin Cities, Tom Osmond here with Jason Davis of KSTP-TV, talking about some of the many adventures and worldwide travels he's done, and New York, Chisholm, Beirut, Iraq, well,
you know,
Kuwait,
the fun places.
The fun places.
New Ulm.
There's one on YouTube right now that you went to, and I can't remember the name of the city, but it was a very old woman that was selling her jam out of her kitchen. And, it was very popular, and she said she turned down buyout offers from other companies to buy it up because she said my recipe will not be diluted or not be compromised. And I think she was 90 years old. This is 30 years ago, so she might not be with us anymore. But
and I don't remember it, but don't give me, I believe.
Well,
you.
I don't remember either, because I'm trying to paraphrase from YouTube.
But that's a very typical story.
That's when I think of the Jason Davis story. Yeah. Those are the stories I love. But this one, Will Steger. Does that name sound familiar there, Tom? Will Steger. Okay.
I just can't do it. Nope.
But you're joking, but a lot of young people don't know the name Will Steger now.
If you were in grade school in the 80s, you know who Will Steger was, because every educator, you know, basically we tracked this trek from to the North Pole. Let's take a listen to this audio from March 1986.
News continues with the team that covers the Twin Cities and all of Minnesota. This is Eyewitness News at 6.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Stan Turner, along with Ruth Spencer. Well, part of the Arctic cold came down our way, south to Minnesota today, Ruth.
But there was certainly enough chill left in the Arctic for Jason Davis. He's in the Canadian town of Resolute, Northwest Territories. That's 2,400 miles north of the Twin Cities. He's been covering the beginning of Will Steger's assault on the ice off Ward Hunt Island, the start of the 500-mile push to the North Pole.
Yes, and we have some broadcast history to make here tonight.
Yes.
We now have Jason live via exclusive satellite from Resolute. That's farther north than any previous live satellite broadcast history. Jason, give us a little sampling, if you can, of the temperatures you've been enduring there in recent times.
Well, right now I guess it's about 40 below Celsius, and you know the scale changes, so it's probably 45 or something like that below Fahrenheit. But you know there's no wind, Stan, and when there's no wind, you can almost stand this. But it's been very cold here. It was 50 below last night with 35 mile an hour winds. That was vicious. You know, travel here is really something. Travel in the summer in the Arctic here is difficult. There are no roads. In the winter, it's almost impossible. The Steger people are traveling to the North Pole by dog sled, but they're spending $60,000 in chartered aircraft just to get to the start.
They are the workhorses of the Arctic, reliable, go-anywhere aircraft called Twin Otters. Over the past few days, they've been shuttling the Steger Polar Expedition from weather station Eureka to the ice of the Polar Sea. Tons of food and equipment and 50 dogs, loaded and unloaded several times before the final destination near Ward Hunt Island, the most northern piece of land in Canada. Yesterday, we were there when the advance party of six began to carve a path through the broken sea ice. This huge field of rubble is the first major barrier on the way to the pole. The task is to get five sleds loaded with at least 1,000 pounds each across this nightmare. Canadian Brent Bodie, spurning synthetic materials, wears a full suit of caribou skin to beat the cold. It's his dogs that have the doubtful honor of breaking trail.
Do you recall that day?
I do. That's a day I'll never forget. It was so cold.
We're going to show some video of that on TCMedianow.com, but I'm looking at the video, and you are in... It's pure white. There's this kind of dark figure in the middle there with a microphone, and there you are, and I think your face is a little blue at that point.
Oh, yeah. It was very difficult circumstances because, as you heard... Nobody had ever done a TV shot from that far north before, mm-hmm. and it was done with the help of the local telephone company. Mm-hmm. And what they did, they got their dish, which was used for telephone communications, and lowered it down to get the satellite that we were using at KSTP. That satellite was over the equator. Mm-hmm. The dish was looking at the horizon, so far north, and that was the very, very limit. You cannot do a broadcast using satellite technology from any further north than that, mm-hmm. because the curvature of the Earth. Not only that, the where we did the live broadcast from was at their little shed in a field where the dish was, and we had to connect directly with bits of wire and mm-hmm. twist them together to connect up to the transmitter that would send our signal down. Our communications with KSTP were with a telephone. Literally a telephone, a little Bakelite phone with a spin dial. You remember those?
Yes.
Well, we didn't realize that would freeze solid, which it did, and created all kinds of terrible problems of communication so that I could hear them. Mm-hmm. They could hear me, but I couldn't hear them. So it was quite an adventure.
Let's play some more audio. This is a couple days after that first audio. Let's more of Jason on the road.
Imagine what it must be like living in sub-zero temperatures, battling the ice and the snow for 2 months, trying to reach the North Pole and being within about 20 miles of the North Pole. That is exactly the situation now for the Will Steger expedition as six brave men and a woman push on towards the top of the world. Jason Davis is live with us right now from Resolute in the Northwest Territories to bring us up to date on the status of the team.
There
Jason.
Is. Ah, good evening. They indeed were slowed down, much to our surprise. We did expect them to be there by today, but they slowed down. We can only expect that it was cloud cover that hid the sun and prevented them from navigating. They have to have the sun out in order to know which way is north. Meantime, here in Resolute, another attempt to reach the North Pole begins tomorrow. Two intrepid Frenchmen are going to leave here in Resolute for the North Pole in magnificent flying machines.
The large French contingent arrived in Resolute nearly a week ago. Two of them are pilots and will attempt to fly their 400-pound ultralight aircraft 1,000 miles from here to the North Pole. 32-year-old Nicolas Hulot is a broadcast journalist, and 37-year-old Hubert de Chavigny actually flies these flimsy aircraft for a living. Hubert de Chavigny says the low temperatures won't worry them, but the weather will.
For the cold, I think everything is okay. We test a lot of things in the very cold rooms before to leave France. But effectively, the wind is a danger for us. And the whiteout, you know, the fog, because we fly with the sun. We have no magnetic compass, so we fly with the sun, and we need to have a clear sky.
The intrepid Frenchmen.
Well, yeah, in those days, the North Pole was a magnet for people that wanted to get there in some different fashion. I mean, Will Steger's expedition was to get there with a dog sled team, unsupported. Mm-hmm. And that was the important word, unsupported. And he was the first to do that since Peary was supposed to have done it back in the 20s. Mm-hmm. But in 1919, I think it was. But there were other people up there trying to get there by hot air balloon. I mean, they've just tried everything. People would ski or walk or ride a bicycle. None of these people were successful.
Well, it becomes showy. I mean, that's being showy when you're trying to just do, you know, a skateboard to the North Pole or a rollerblade in the North Pole.
I guess I was just trying to make a name for them. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. But
we met quite a few of them.
But Will's an amazing guy. He came and spoke at my school, I think, in two separate occasions in my public school career. And I'm assuming you still keep in touch with Will.
Oh, yeah. Will and I still keep in touch, but not on a daily basis. But sure. we're aware of each other's existence.
And what's he up to now?
Well, as Will is now has a foundation that deals with the dangers of global warming in general. Specifically, I think it's also about energy conservation and all kinds of things like that. He's deeply involved in that.
So was that the coldest on the road you ever did?
That was the coldest. I had some pretty cold times covering the John Bagri sled dog race in northern Minnesota.
That's right.
And I must correct myself from in that report. I said it was 40 degrees Celsius. Well, as it happens, the scale is 40 degrees Celsius below and 40 degrees Fahrenheit below are exactly the same. That's the only point on the
really?
Scale
okay.
where they meet.
Because I thought it might be like 80 below.
No,
40 Fahrenheit.
Degrees Celsius is 40 degrees Fahrenheit.
Oh, that's where you were going with it too.
And I have to admit, Jason, in all due respect, you looked a little cold there. I think that, and I was watching the video.
I was watching
the video, and there were, I mean, the frostbite that guys were getting on this trip, and some of the physical effects of being in the cold. That was, and not to be punny, that was very chilling to see that.
I had to do a commentary to camera at one point when they set off, at the point they set off, and it was 65 degrees below zero there at some point while we were there. And I had to wear a complete face mask on camera, which looks absolutely absurd. But there was no way you could have exposed skin under those conditions.
Well, I'm very curious because, like, just trying to talk in Minnesota when it's negative 20 degrees outside,
your face freezes.
Your nose.
Your face freezes, sure.
So how did you give that kind of, you know, well-enunciated speech?
I don't know. I was a lot
40.
Younger.
I'm just happy that the
my blood supply was a lot stronger.
The image consultants had come to you and said, "Jason, you got to take off the hat. We need to show some.
Oh,
we need to show your hair. You need to show."
I think Stan knew that wasn't a practical thing to do.
We've Tom and I have interviewed a couple ladies in here who said that they were told not to wear hats in the winter because it wasn't good for ratings. Wasn't good to not show that blonde. Blonde flowing hair.
I know we're running out of time, but we had another wonderful experience with the whales trapped in the ice up in Barrow, Alaska. And we covered that one from the Twin Cities. Here's a long story why we did that and a legitimate reason for us to be there. And I saw the movie called The Big Miracle.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I'm in that movie. If you stay right through the credits, you'll see me at the end
You're
of the credits.
You're at the end of the credits?
I'm in the movie, yeah.
Whoa!
Which is really a great thrill for my kids. My family, and my grandchildren, because I took them all to see it and didn't tell them, and there I was.
So Jason Davis is in the movie title again? What's the movie title?
Big Miracle.
Big Miracle.
The Big Miracle.
Mm.
Check
now,
it
was
out.
Was that old footage, or was that like you?
No, it was old footage.
I was wondering if they just brought you in for it.
Up where the whales were. They used a lot of our video to base their movie on.
I hope they got some residuals from
no.
that. Okay.
Unfortunately not. Maybe KSTP did, but I didn't see a penny of it.
In fact, we were having this conversation a while ago about using footage for without residuals. TCMedia.com might come to mind.
I can't sell the video. That's how
no.
it belongs to Stanley Hubbard.
No. So I've told you about my favorite stories. What is your favorite story in 37 years of doing this job? What's the one? I'm sure you have three or four, but what's one if you could do it all over again?
Everybody
you do it?
Asks me that question, and with the thousands and thousands of stories, it's very difficult to give you a straight answer.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not evading the question.
No.
But we've covered some of the most important and exciting things that we've ever done. Jerry Spies arriving in Falmouth, you know, after going across the Atlantic in a 10-foot boat, flying to the North Pole, getting off the plane and embracing Will Steger and the rest of the team, and then coming back with them to Minnesota, to St. Paul with the reception. It's just been wonderful experiences.
But the great thing is you can go to North Pole and then you can go to the Sportsman's Cafe in Mora.
And I have just as good a time.
And
I enjoy very much. We do stories all the time. We just finished a story just the day before yesterday about two young guys from Minnesota who actually portaged a canoe from Minneapolis to Eveleth, Minnesota.
I saw that. That was a great story.
Well, you haven't seen it.
I've read about it.
Because we were the only ones there when they got there. And that's a wonderful story. They raise money for the camp that they work at. YMC camp in Eveleth, and it was just a terrific story for me. I just loved it.
You love people and you love stories, and that's the best.
It's all about people.
Mm-hmm.
So I was curious, since you said you can't pick a favorite. Let's go the polar opposite. What is the worst story?
No. He won't say that, but I will ask him. What is the oddest one you've ever done? What is the one where you thought this is
you've
really
caught
different?
Me here. they are just so peculiar. But it's the people.
Mm-hmm.
They're just strange, you know. And they do. I did a story about a guy in Iowa years ago, 30 years ago, who changed his name to Welcome Pleasure Freely. He was in the phone book. I mean, that was a wonderful story. He was a little quirky, as you might can imagine. That kind of thing just sets me on fire. I just love stories like that. I did a story about a man that was walking backwards forever. I mean, that's the way he walked. It was up on the reservation in northern Minnesota. Visually, they're so compelling.
Well, I'm guessing sometimes when you see one of these you read about, like, this person's going to be really odd. And I'm guessing sometimes they are odd, and other times you probably are surprised that they were more like you or more mainstream than you thought they were.
They're not mentally ill. They're just.
No, I didn't say mentally ill.
They're just what was the word we
used? Quirky, maybe.
Quirky.
Everyone's good as quirky.
I like the word eccentric.
There you go.
Eccentrics are revered in Europe, but here eccentric kind of means a little wacky.
You have to be eccentric to be in broadcasting, don't you think?
Probably.
I just want you to know, you also planted the seed. He's going to be changing his name here shortly.
What's the name? Carefree Pleasure?
Welcome Pleasure Freely.
Well, if there isn't one, you know, I'm looking for a stage name. Well, it's great. And so you have some new stories coming up this year.
Yes, we do.
So on the road, there is new episodes occasionally.
There are new episodes occasionally, and we got in July we'll have two or three. They are compilation programs. By and large, one of them will be new, which will be the story about the folk in St. Lucia working to bring the IQ of the country up, working with the children. It's quite compelling. It's a beautiful country. It's not a country that a lot of people know a lot about.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a small island. We were able to see all of it, and we shot a lot of visual content for that.
That's great.
So it's a great escape story, too. And also has this compelling story about trying to educate the kids and make life better for them there.
That's great. Next week on the show, we're going to announce the Pavic Museum Broadcast Hall of Fame new inductees for 2013. You, sir, were inducted in 2008. I was at the ceremony. You had a great speech. Talked about you had no idea about this revolving door KSDP because your door's never revolved since you got there in 1976.
No.
It was a great speech and a great night.
I don't know what they're talking about.
Don't know what they're talking about. And tell me a little bit about that. That must have been a great night for you and the family to be able to induct it.
It was. My family were there, at least as many as could be there. It was quite an honor. It's nice to be recognized, especially as I came up sort of the hard way. I didn't come through college and journalism school and work my way up that way. I came in through the back door.
Mm-hmm.
And to be recognized by people who are highly educated and are the best in the business, I was thrilled to bits.
It's a great group of people, and it's a great roster of that Hall of Fame. And I've seen the list, and so it's going to be some good inductees, which we're actually going to have on the show. Jason, thank you for coming up today. I love talking about these stories and love hearing that old audio, and especially that Will Steger trip to the North Pole. That was a great part of when I was in grade school, just following that trek up the North Pole and hoping everyone made it there back and alive. And one of the best videos, which we will show, is everyone at the airport when the governor's there and Stan Turner's there, and you guys all come and...
Yeah.
Back to the cold of Minnesota. This is Flashback Twin Cities. I am Tom Osmond. We'll be back next week with Pat Miles, formerly of Channel 4 and Channel 11. So, till then, so long.